Grade 4 Conference, Lecture 31, Norse Mythology, Part 9. We see the difference in the creation of Ymir and these, what eventually become the three leading Aesir gods, that Ymir, we could say, is the result of a chemical reaction, or at least a physical reaction, of two contrasting elements, ice and fire. And we could say the ice is like that primal world of perfection. The fire is Saturn, that which is going to bring something very new into being. And it takes time for them to meet. And when they do, then clunk, crash, down comes this physical being. A little bit like the way in which many scientists, biophysicists in particular, may believe that, you know, we can create an entirely new kind of human being. Just get the chemicals right and get the electronics right and we've got it. We may, but we may have the Ymir figure. And we could say that Mary Shelley's Frankenstein has, as it were, the last vestiges of this imagination. When the more beautiful, more radiant figure comes into being, that is a kind of artistic activity. Udmula does the best she can with her tongue and sculpts him out of the ice. That takes more time and more care. And then that, in a way, alchemically has to be refined down a couple of generations so that what was one being who then meets up with a daughter of a giant, two beings, then becomes three beings. So that Trinitarian quality can arise. And now we say he's radiant. These figures sort of give off light. So here we're in the sun, where light starts to shine into this darkness, but the darkness doesn't understand it and doesn't like it and doesn't want it. What's going on here is something else that Steiner speaks of as being a pillar of his evolutionary picture, casting off. Not so much in the way that we taught the first graders how to do that in knitting, but that in the spiritual world, beings must divest themselves of their impurities, of their imperfections, like a kind of alchemical reaction again, a kind of precipitation in which you release that which is coarse and crude, so that the finest liquid only, and finally the vapor, rises to the top. So what has happened is that the spiritual world has had to cast off the cruder and coarser aspects of being a physical being, and that manifests as Ymir. We could say that, speaking in a more modern sense, maybe we'd say that's the age of the dinosaurs. That's the kind of earliest Cro-Magnon sort of human being, or even the animals that precede that. These are all beings who are cast off and become a kind of subnatural force. However, and this is an important part of Steiner's evolutionary picture as well, it's not like they just, amicably go off to their place in the world and stay there. Instead, right away, Ymir feels hatred for these radiant beings. He and his Jotuns, his giants, want to overcome them. They do not accept the march of progress. They do not accept that something inevitable is occurring now in evolutionary terms. They are going to stick around. And they are never going to forgive the radiant beings, the Aesir, for what they are about to do. So a great battle ensues, not by any means the last one. And I would say again, looking towards grade 5, you're going to see this kind of picture, this story, arise time and time again as a more developed, a more evolutionarily forward-looking people must overcome those who would hold the course of evolution back. And it's going to manifest in terms of gods. It's going to manifest also in terms of human beings. The figure first licked out of the mountain by Urbhuma had not just a four-letter name, a three-letter name. His name was Bur, B-U-R, as in really cold. And then he has his grandchildren become the three leading gods. So there's tremendous animosity between these figures of light and radiance and lightness and the figures of darkness and heaviness. A great battle ensues, and finally they are able to destroy Ymir and all of his children, except for one, or sometimes it's said two, whose name was Bergelmir, and he found a woman giant, and then they were able to perpetuate the race of the giants. So they were almost completely destroyed, because when Ymir was cast into the waters rose up tremendously due to his great bulk and weight, and all of the Jotuns, that generation of Jotuns, perished, except for these one or two who start the race then. And now they flee, but they're not going to disappear by any means. And let me just share with you the lovely way in which Patriarch Colum describes what comes next. Now Odin and his sons took the body of Ymir, the vastest body that ever was, and they flung it into the chasm of chasms, filling up all the hollow places with it. They dug the bones out of the body, and they piled them up as the mountains. They took the teeth out, and they made them into the rocks. They took the hair of Ymir, and they made it into the forests of trees. They took his eyebrows and formed them into the place where men now dwell, Midgard. And out of Ymir's hollow skull, they made the sky. And Odin and his sons and brothers did more than this. They took the sparks and the clouds of flame that blew from Muspelheim, and they made them into the sun and the moon and all the stars that are in the sky. Odin found a dusky giantess named Night, whose son was called Day, and he gave both of them horses to drive across the sky. Night drove a horse that is named Hrimfaxa, Frosty Mane, and Day drove a horse that is named Skinfaxa, Shining Mane. From Hrimfaxa's bit fall the drops that make the dew upon the earth. So here we see how the being of Ymir, not willingly in this story, sacrifices his physical body so that the earth can become firm and hard and ready then, fit for human habitation. Because we are the hierarchical group, we human beings going through our human stage now, who are going to be the first and the only ones to do it in circumstances of tremendous physical density and hardness. That's our task. But for this, a being must be sacrificed. Now, I would say, of course, this is the way we want to describe it, and it is a war and a battle, and the children will be very thrilled by all of this. But we have to recognize within ourselves, within our own understanding of the story, that what is going on here is that actually Ymir is a very lofty being. He is a throne. On the earth, he falls asleep because this is not his realm. He cannot in any way bring his lofty cosmic consciousness into a wakeful state on the earth. So he appears clumsy, stupid, and so on. But when you see this, this is the mark very often of a very lofty spiritual being trying to find his way in very different conditions. And he then gives up his nature, this very, very high throne being from the highest of the hierarchies. He gives it up so that we can have solid ground upon which to walk. And then, in a way, his spiritual nature returns to its rightful place as he continues to evolve further. He doesn't need anything physical anymore. He can give it all up. We need the physical now. We're not ready to give it up by any means. And the gods are going to mediate between the physical body that we as human beings need and their own divine nature. And I think that we can say that the three sons, this Trinity, have a great deal to do with the astral body. And they have the responsibility for meeting and molding this physical world in a very new way so that it can truly be a reflection of the divine. But it's not going to be easy. Already, the physical etheric forces, these forces of tremendous, endless growth, this giganticism, this is not just going to go off and skulk in the corner. It's going to remain as an active force, which these radiant Aesir beings must again and again meet. As I said before, they're always going to be saying, let's go down there. I hear there's something very interesting brewing down there. I want to meet this giant. I need to fight this giant. I need to overcome this giant. I need to be challenged by this giant. This is again and again the astral body trying to go more deeply than the etheric world and continue the work of transforming the rough and heavy and coarse materiality of the physical world into something that is of the nature of soul and perhaps even of the nature of spirit. So this is, the theme is already set. It lives inherent in the creation of the world. It is part of its very fiber that the radiant world from above must meet the coarse physical world from below. That this is, in another more pictorial form, very similar to Rudolf Steiner's evolutionary picture of Earth development. We will go on.